Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and our online audiences. It's my great pleasure to reintroduce Ross King to you. He was here 4 years ago on Leonardo and the Last Supper. How many people remember and came to that lecture? All right, so he was here speaking about, you know, Leonardo da Vinci's creation of the Last Supper. And now he's here speaking about Mad Enchantment, Claude Monet, and the painting of the water lilies. And it's obviously imagery that we are all completely aware of, not just the early ones, but these huge panel paintings that he did near the end of his life, of his own garden. And, of course, as soon as I heard that Ross was coming back to San Francisco, I said, absolutely. So, Ross King.
Thank you, George. Thanks for coming out. It's great to be back here. It's hard to believe it was 4 years since I was here last. And I've tackled someone who I find even more fascinating than Leonardo da Vinci in Claude Monet. All of you are Monet fans. How many of you have been to Giverny? Wow, I forget which other city I asked it in. I think it was in Chicago. And they didn't even have that high a percentage. So it's well done. How many of you have seen the Orangerie in Paris? Well, once again, fantastic. Well, we might as well go home now. You probably know everything. Anyway, I'm going to show you some lovely pictures and give you a bit of a backstory. I did Moira Gunn's interview earlier today, and she said, on Tech Nation, and she said, you're the king of the backstory. And I said, no, I'm the king of the irrelevant anecdote, maybe. And so I'll give you some irrelevant anecdotes as well. But we'll also look at some of these beautiful pictures. In his own lifetime, Monet was referred to as the painter of happiness. And I think we can understand and appreciate why that is, because he gives us these gorgeous visions of the French countryside, the beautiful rural idylls in France with the woman and the child, and I'll talk about them in a little bit. The beautiful meadow outside of Giverny that he painted in 1886. A friend of Claude Monet said that he painted nature with warm breaths of love and spasms of joy. And I did a book, I curated an exhibition of Canadian post-impressionism about 6 years ago, looking at Canadian landscape painters, and they did not show nature with warm breaths of love and spasms of joy. Nature is very much red in tooth and claw in their paintings, and they deliberately were trying to get away from the Monet influence. These are images that I think we would all like to walk into, participate in, go for a walk in Monet country, in Monet's countryside. And in his own lifetime, many people discussed the calming effect of his paintings, the beauty and tranquility of them, and the effect they could have on the human psyche. And one of Monet's greatest fans was Marcel Proust, the great writer. Proust never actually met him, and he never went to Monet's garden, but he was very anxious to see it. However, Proust, as you might know, is extremely asthmatic. And if you went to visit him, he forced you to take the flower out of your buttonhole so you wouldn't trigger a potentially fatal asthma attack. So had he visited Giverny, remembrance of things past may have been somewhat abbreviated. And in my case, I might have been able to finish it. But Marcel Proust wrote how in Monet's paintings, nature appeared so beautifully that his paintings served the purpose or served the function of certain psychotherapists, he said. He equated Monet's paintings with psychotherapy. You didn't need Freud, in other words, you needed Monet. And one of my favorite recent quotes about Monet that gives us the sort of flavor of his popularity comes from Philip Hook, who was an impressionist expert at Sotheby's in London. And the Sunday Times in Britain asked him, why is Monet so popular? They asked this at the end of 2014, when if you totaled up how much everyone's art sold for that year, Monet beat everyone. And so they asked Philip Hook, why is he so popular? Why does everyone go to the blockbuster exhibitions, etc.? And Hook said, oh, it's very easy. He's the great antidepressant. And in some ways, Monet would not have objected to that kind of categorization because of the fact that he himself wanted his paintings to have a therapeutic value. And he actually talked about the way he wanted his paintings to offer an asylum of peaceful meditation to people where those stressed out by modern life could come and effectively calm down or become very calm. And to that end, what he envisaged by the 1890s, when he was past the midpoint of his career, was a sort of what we would call an installation or an immersive experience where he would decorate a room with his beautiful paintings. Specifically, he wanted to decorate his room with paintings of his lily pond. In 1897, a journalist came to interview him, and he said in the interview published the following March, "Imagine a circular room, the lower walls covered with paintings a meter high, entirely filled with a plain of water scattered with these plants, transparent screens, etc." I'll come to the lily pond in a few minutes. He began constructing it in 1893, and it would take him about 10 years in total. But halfway through that process of building it, in 1897, he was already envisaging the creation, using it to create a kind of chill room or something like that. He was going to take his lily pond from its horizontal position, raise it vertically onto the walls with these wraparound canvases. And just one thing I'll point out about this quote, look at how he's thinking. It's a circular room. The paintings are about a meter high. And so what he wanted to do is to offer a kind of a greater sensory experience to the viewer than you would get just through framed points of focus on the wall. And I'm not ruining the end of my story by saying he ultimately did do something like that many times over. But if you look at these paintings, they're not half the height of a man. They're not 3 feet 3 feet high. They're 6 foot 6 inches high. And this is what he called the Grande Décoration, the Great Decoration, that he began working on in 1914 and worked on effectively until his death in 1926. So during the last 12 years of his life. I think, one of the great achievements of 20th century art, and was important to 20th century, as important to 20th century art as Impressionism was to 19th century art. And of course, he was very much involved in the formation of Impressionism in the 1860s and 1870s. And it's quite remarkable, therefore, that he was as creative and as productive and as innovative late in life when he was in his 70s and 80s, because that's how old he was when he was working on these, as he was in his 20s and 30s. And so what I do in Mad Enchantment is, what I do in most of my other books is, I drill down deeply into a particular time period, in this case 1914 to 26, and look at, in effect, I try to reverse engineer what the artist has done, the way I did with Leonardo in The Last Supper, for example. Because there's a temptation when you have such great works of art to think, works that become icons, the temptation is to think that, of course, they were going to be a success. That in 1494, when Leonardo began painting The Last Supper, 1508, when Michelangelo began painting The Vault of the Sistine Chapel, or 1914, when Monet began painting The Water Lilies, of course these things were going to be successful because these were such artistic geniuses. But the more closely you look at them, and as I say, when you reverse engineer them, you realize that there was much more to it than that. And it is, in fact, surprising in many ways that these works ever got finished, let alone became such masterpieces, because of the way in which circumstances, personal circumstances, historical circumstances conspired against all of them. And when I talk about historical circumstances conspiring against someone, I'm sure the year 1914 leapt out at you, because, of course, that was the year that World War I broke out. So Monet began painting these during World War I, and in fact, he continued, as I'll describe in a few minutes, through the course of the war. And he also fought very difficult personal battles during those war years as well. Now, Monet doesn't need a whole lot of information, especially to a group like this, virtually all of whom have done the Monet trail in Paris and Giverny. But if just a bit of context, born in 1840, died in 1926, and his longevity is quite remarkable due to the fact that this is about the only picture I've ever seen of him, the only photograph I've ever seen, when there isn't a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He was a dedicated chain smoker, despite which he lived about 6 weeks past his 86th birthday. He was born in Paris, left as effectively as a toddler, lived on the Normandy coast, and then came back to Paris at the age of 19 at the end of the 1850s to become a painter and to study in a painting studio. And of course, within a couple of years, he'd fallen in with the group of avant-garde painters that we now call the Impressionists, and that we call the Impressionists in part because of this painting that he did in 1872 and that he exhibited 2 years later at the what we now call the First Impressionist Exhibition. They had called themselves the Society of Independent Artists. This group of Manet did not show with them, but Monet, Cezanne, Pizarro, Renoir, etc. They called themselves the Society of Independent Artists, which isn't even catchy in French. And the press, when they saw paintings like this, derided them and said they're not painters, they're impressionists. And ultimately, the painters themselves embraced that name. But originally, it was meant pejoratively. And in fact, there was a lot of there were many pejorative comments about the impressionists. They were really scorned by the critics, treated with much hostility by the public, and treated with indifference by the collectors who didn't buy their works in the 1860s and 70s. And this is sort of typical of the kind of attitude that there was toward them, where the gendarme is hastily cautioning the pregnant woman that she mustn't enter the Impressionist exhibition because of the damage that might be done to her unborn child. And so they were these demonic figures in painting. And incidentally, anyone who's interested in that period in the life of Monet and the lives of the other Impressionists, I modestly refer you to The Judgment of Paris, which I wrote 10 years ago, and which is still available at all good bookstores. And I now call it the prequel to Mad Enchantment, which really tells the end of the story. And in some ways, the end of the story was nice for me to tell, because the scorn and derision did not last forever. And really, by the many of the Impressionists died before the turn of the 20th century, but Monet lived a long time, and he lived long enough to enjoy great acclaim. And in fact, by the first decade of the 20th century, he was regarded as the greatest of all French painters, possibly, as Remy de Gourmont said, very important novelist Remy de Gourmont, said he was perhaps the greatest painter who had ever lived. And so Monet became the grand old man of French painting, and Paul Cézanne, who had been a very close friend of his for many years, said he was simply the best. And I've deleted the expletive in front of that, but that Cézanne was a very earthy fellow. I do reproduce it in the book, but I'll spare our blushes tonight by not using it. But that encomium from Cézanne was probably meant more to Monet than all of these other comments, all of the other great reviews he got, because he thought Paul Cézanne was the greatest of all painters. In fact, he had 14 Cézanne paintings. He was one of the few people who bought Cézanne paintings. And in fact, when Monet's work was not going well, his wife would discreetly drape the 14 Cézannes so they weren't staring down reprovingly at Monet, who felt he couldn't equal what Cézanne had done. He said, "I feel painting before Cézanne, I feel a pygmy at the foot of a giant." And sadly for Cézanne, he died in 1906, and most of his acclaim was posthumous. And it was only people like, only the cognoscenti like Monet who were buying his work during his lifetime. And he really was living in a kind of seclusion or reclusion in the south of France. Happily for Monet, though, he, as I say, lived long enough. He lived 20 years more than Cézanne and had great wealth that came with his acclaim, thanks to the fact that he was discovered by Gilded Age America, by people such as Mrs. Potter Palmer, Bertha Palmer, in Chicago, who in 1907, the Chicago Sunday Tribune asked the searching question, is Mrs. Potter Palmer the only American woman who knows how to spend a fortune? And one of the things she spent her fortune on, and with which she covered the walls of her castle in Chicago on Lake Michigan, were Monet's paintings. In 1891, She went to Paris on a Monet buying spree and came back with 25 of them. And ultimately, she bought more than 50 of them. I'm sorry, more than 90 of them. And she wasn't even that unusual. The Fifth Avenue in New York, Newport, Rhode Island, places like that were full of plutocrats, Gilded Age tycoons, who collected Monet's paintings. And so he was the great beneficiary of this, such a beneficiary that as early as the late 1880s, when this sort of Monet gold rush began, a French critic wrote that the rapacity of the Yankees was going to steal all of the Monets from France, and France would be denuded of the paintings by her greatest painter. But in fact, there was little chance of that because Monet was a painting machine, and there was always going to be enough paintings to go around. But he himself had somewhat ambivalent feelings about the fact that his paintings were going to America, because sadly, he conforms to the stereotype or the cliche of the Gallic snob who looks down on the Americans. And in 1920, when he was told that how his works had sold in New York at vast prices, higher than they had ever reached before, he said, and he was in a very bad mood at the time, but he said, this merely proves the stupidity of the public. But having said that, he never refused to cash any of the checks because he was very happy to have all of this American money. And this American money, of course, he was bought by French collectors, German collectors, English collectors, but it allowed him to live in the style to which he aspired. And that, first and foremost, was Giverny, his northwest of Paris in the Seine Valley, to which he moved in 1883. And he began renting the house in the background here in 1883, but after the Monet gold rush of the 1880s, he was able to purchase it in 1890. And once he owned it outright, he could begin work on the garden. It was an old Norman cider press. It was a cider-producing property. He got rid of all the apple orchards and things like that, which the neighbors thought was crazy. He was getting rid of agricultural crops and planting flowers just for his enjoyment. But of course, his flowers were worth much more than apples were, because he began, once he translated them onto canvas, they were worth a huge amount of money. And with the money that he made, he began doing things like purchasing automobiles. He was a car nut. He absolutely loved fast cars. He had a garage full of them. He built a garage specially to house them at the house in Giverny. He had a personal chef who cooked what was said to be the best food in France. One of the most coveted invitations you could ever get in France was an invitation to Sunday lunch with him, because you had this wonderful food and you would get the tour of the garden, which was tended to by a team of six gardeners, because of course he had not just the garden immediately behind the house that you saw in that last photo, but also the water garden, which, as I said, he began building in 1893, 3 years after he purchased the house. He had water diverted from a river that was running through and began planting water lilies. And after about 10 years, by 1903, it had reached its definitive form, the form in which we see it today, complete with the bridges, the wisteria, the irises, the agapanthi, etc., etc. He began painting it. And it really became his favorite motif for the rest of his life. From 1903 until 1926, he painted very little but his water garden. And he unveiled it. He began a painting campaign in 1903, completed 48 canvases in 1908, and then the year later, he exposed them at his picture dealer in Paris, the Galerie Durand-Ruel, and so it was called the Water Lily Series of Landscapes of Water by Claude Monet, and so he unveiled his water garden and his new water paintings, and it was really the high point of his career. He had been going from strength to strength in terms of his exhibitions of the haystacks, the poplars, the London scenes, etc., but these were by far the most popular of all of his works and got reviews such as this one in the Gazette des Beaux-Arts, which is probably the most important of the art magazines who the art critic wrote, for as long as mankind has been around, for as long as artists have painted, no one has ever painted better than this, which is probably about as good a review as anyone has ever had about anything. It's really something for the scrapbook. And so it was spectacularly successful. These critically, commercially, newspapers very quickly began a campaign, at least five of them, to try to get at least part of this collection of paintings held together, purchased for the French state, so that people could appreciate them in situ somewhere, in whether it was going to be a public museum or whether a philanthropist was going to buy them and put them on display in his home. But the philosophy was that these needed to be kept together because, of course, they spoke to one another. Each one took its meaning from the ones around it because they were all painted often from the same spot but at different times of the day. And so it was a sequence, and they should all be kept together, it was believed. And so critics, a very important art critic, Arsène Alexandre, wrote in, again, another very important art magazine, "Will the millionaire who is needed read these lines?" And he talks about how the paintings could have decorated a circular room of modest dimensions. And those, so this is very similar to Monet's dream from almost 10 years earlier, 10 or 11 years earlier, where he wanted to have this living room decorated with paintings about 3 feet high. And so at this point, it's still quite modest. They're going to be paintings 3 feet high decorating a circular room. But sadly for Monet, he was a victim of his own success, and the paintings all sold, and they were not kept together. Many of them, for example, came to the United States. And so he was balked in this ambition to have this installation that he'd been dreaming about for about a dozen years by this point. Now, if in 1909 he was at the height of his powers as a painter, commercially, critically, he was the next couple of years were very difficult ones for him because, of course, if you're at the top of the Wheel of Fortune, the only direction to go is down, and he did begin to go down. First and foremost, or most tragically, because of the death of his beloved wife, Felice, his second wife. His first wife had died decades earlier, but he became a widower for the second time in 1911, and he wrote to all of his friends saying, "I am annihilated," and he said he was unable to paint any longer. He then suffered another bereavement a couple of years later when his eldest son, Jean, the little boy in that first painting that I showed you, died at the age of 46. It died horribly. No one's entirely sure what he died from, possibly syphilis, but the symptoms were terrible. And Monet found it extremely harrowing to witness the death of his oldest son. He had two of his own boys and then six stepchildren through Elise. And so the final tragedy that he had, the third blow, came when he discovered he was losing his eyesight. He went out to paint one day and found that he couldn't see properly. And he was diagnosed with cataracts and told that he was probably going to have to need surgery. And I should just stress, for anyone who's had cataract surgery recently, the cataract surgery in 100 years ago was not quite as good as it is today. And so Monet was understandably reluctant. But I think we can appreciate the difficult period he was going through at this point time, because it's very hard for anyone to contemplate the loss of their sight, maybe even harder for painters, people who make their living through their vision, and people who appreciate beauty as much as Monet did. And then I think Monet in particular, because of the fact that he was seen as having the greatest vision in the history of art. It was believed at the end of the 19th century that Monet had a kind, almost preternaturally good vision. Some people wrote that he was a kind of more highly evolved human being insofar as he could see colors at the ultraviolet end of the spectrum that no one else could see. And so when he painted, he showed us things that were really beyond our own abilities to see. And so he had this gift from the gods, but that gift was now being taken away from him. And so unsurprisingly, perhaps, he stopped painting. In 1912, 1913, he did very little painting. And in January 1913, he wrote to his picture dealer, Paul Durand-Ruel, saying, "I always wanted to believe that I would make headway and finally do something worthwhile, but alas, I must now bury that hope." And you can imagine Durand Ruel's heart sinking when he read this, because Monet was his most lucrative painter by far, and now Monet was saying he was going to quit painting. And it's interesting to find Monet at this stage of his career. At this point, he was 72 years old, and he believed that the end to his career had come. He might have achieved a lot, but it wasn't everything that he had wanted to achieve. And in many ways, the story could have ended there. And in fact, it did end there for a number of his colleagues. Mary Cassatt, who went blind, who underwent five unsuccessful cataract operations on her eyes. It ended for Edgar Degas, who had effectively stopped painting a number of years earlier. It had ended for Camille Pissarro, who died a decade before this after suffering infirmities with his eyes for the last decade of his life. And it had ended for Monet's teacher, Charles Glaire, who Monet went into his studio in 1860, and Glaire lost his eyesight and had to stop painting. So there were all of these precedents of things that had happened to people that Monet knew and to whom he had been close. And so it looked like, in 1913, it looked like he was going to stop painting. Fortunately, that's when the second character in the book really steps in and makes a change. When I began writing Mad Enchantment or doing the research, I knew a lot about Monet. I had all sorts of notes on him. I'd read much about him. I knew much less about Clemenceau, and he was a real revelation, and I have to say an absolutely fascinating character. He was absolutely unstoppable, indomitable, and he was Monet's best friend. The two of them went back many decades. If you asked Clemenceau who his best friend was, he would have unhesitatingly said that his best friend was Monet. In 1914, he was a senator, and even more important, he was the editor of a daily newspaper. He had been prime minister of France from 1906 to 9, and then again, of course, more famously in 1917, he became PM again. He wrote many letters to Monet and had various affectionate nicknames for him. He would write to him and say, dear old lunatic, or dear old crustacean, or my favorite, he called him the abominable hedgehog. But he came by his own nickname very honestly, the tiger, because he was a terrifying figure. In January 1914, French journalist wrote of him that the whole world trembles before him. He was so intimidating. He struck fear into the hearts of everyone. One of my favorite quotes of his is, "Life is a combat. I pity those people who want to make friends with everyone." And he was happy to make enemies. And he experienced a lot of combat in the course of his long journalistic and political career, including 22 duels with swords and pistols against fellow journalists and politicians, all of which obviously he won. And his opponents did not know that the deck was stacked against them, because in the 1860s, as a young man, he went to America. He went into a kind of self-imposed exile because he was politically opposed to the Emperor Napoleon III. And the job he took in Connecticut, rural Connecticut, was as fencing master at a girls' school. And so if you challenged him to, if you threw down the gauntlet, little did you know that the fencing master from the Connecticut girls' school was going to be your opponent. But he came to visit Monet in 1914, April 1914, and wanted to get him out of the doldrums and wanted to get him painting again, partly because he believed in Monet as a painter and thought he could still do great work, but partly because he knew a Monet who was not painting was never going to be happy, and that the end certainly would come for him very quickly if he stopped painting. And so according to Clemenceau's version of events, he went to Monet on this Sunday afternoon, had lunch with him, and then went to look at some of his paintings that Monet hadn't done anything with. And among them, he saw some paintings, some of the very first paintings Monet had done of his water lily pond before the pond was really finished in about 1899, 1900. And he said, "These are rather good. Why don't you do some more of these? Why don't you go sit beside your pond again and paint some more works? And then why don't you find a millionaire to buy them, a rich man to buy them, and decorate the room?" So he revived this ancient dream that Monet had had for almost 20 years by this point. Now, this was an extremely risky strategy on the part of Clemenceau to ask Monet to begin painting his lily ponds again, because there's a certain irony, in fact, a great irony, in Monet being the great antidepressant. We might think that this is a pleasant occupation, sitting out in the sun under a parasol, painting a beautiful scene with the skills that God has given you. But Clemenceau had another nickname for Monet, and that was King of the Grouches, because Monet flew into terrible rages as he painted. So his scenes may have been very beautiful, tranquil, and evocative of peace and tranquility, but he was anything but as he painted them. I don't know how many of you remember Fawlty Towers, but I think it was the Basil Fawlty of painting and giving a damn good thrashing to the works that failed to live up to his high standards, because there are many descriptions of him stabbing his paintings, slashing them with his knife, burning them in bonfires, and stamping on them. He often wore wooden clogs as he painted, and he would stamp on them with his wooden clogs. And in the book, I describe about how he, in 1895, he went to Norway to paint the snow, and a Norwegian critic came to see the great Claude Monet in the open-air painting. And he was treated to the unedifying spectacle of Monet in a terrible tantrum, stamping on his canvases in a snowbank. And this happened repeatedly. And all artists destroy work and paint over their works and discreetly get rid of them, etc. But I think what marked Monet out was the violence with which he attacked his canvases and also the terrible rages that he worked himself into. And he described painting as a kind of torture. Again and again, he would say things like, ah, how I suffer, how painting makes me suffer, it tortures me, the pain it causes me, and so forth. So it was something that he found absolutely brutal and terribly difficult. And the great riskiness of Clemenceau's strategy then was that no paintings had ever given Monet as much difficulty and caused as many problems as the water lilies he had painted between 1903 and 1908, the ones which ultimately, when 48 of them went on display, became this great sensation. But these ones drove him to distraction more than anything else he had ever done, and that really is saying something. He destroyed many, many of the canvases that he started, and he flew into terrible rages. His friend, a very important art critic, writer, curator, Gustave Geoffroy, said that he was pursuing his dream of form and color almost to the point of self-annihilation. And that may be a bit of an exaggeration in with the self-annihilation. But if we think of what Monet was trying to do with these paintings, we can appreciate the difficulties that he encountered, because we do get the water lilies in a form of perspective, but everything else then is sort of coalescing or uncoalescing. What he was trying to, he's eradicated all of the markers of traditional landscape painting. There's no foreground, no middle ground, no distance. He's not painting the sky. He's painting just the reflection of the sky, just the reflection of clouds, the reflections of trees, the movement of the water. So he's trying to capture light, shade, water, reflection, sunlight, all of these things that are intangible, impalpable, and also, crucially, that are ever-changing. And so the attempts to do this really did almost drive him to the brink of insanity, and he suffered terrible rages, ones that were so bad that he would take himself off to a nearby hotel to spare his family what they euphemistically called his mood swings as he worked. The exhibition was supposed to be in 1907, but he had to cancel it because of the fact that he was so unhappy with what he had done and thought that he couldn't put any of this on display. And his wife, Elise, claimed that he was making her life a misery, which I'm sure he was at that point. So it was very risky then for Clemenceau to tell him to go and sit beside what Geoffroy called the luminous abyss of the water lily pond and start painting again, especially since the calming influence of Elise was no longer there, because, of course, she died a couple of years earlier. However, Clemenceau was successful in persuading Monet to begin work again. And just as in 1913, Monet's retirement was reported in the newspapers, So in 1914 was his coming out of retirement reported. He was the, once again, if I can use another analogy from the 1970s, he was the Joe Namath of painting at this point. And the newspapers described the way in which you could see, if you took the train through Giverny, you could see Monet painting once again with his amazing sensitivities, the marvelous colors newly enchanting his eyes that, thank God, see as clearly as before. And that's a puzzling statement because it appears that Monet's vision, A, was either coming back, which I think was maybe unlikely, or B, he was accommodating his painting to his the deterioration of his eyesight. In any case, between 1914 and about 1920, Monet complained about virtually everything, but not once did he complain about his eyesight. So whatever his eye problems were, he was somehow able to live with it, or he did get greater periods of lucidity. And so at the end of June 1914, he wrote to Paul Durand Ruel saying, "I am back at work. Everything goes well." And you can imagine how delighted Durand Ruel was. The two of them could now sell all of these new paintings he was doing to the rich Americans, and all would be well. But if you look at the date of that, June the 29th, 1914, it's a very evocative date because we might want to imagine Monet writing the letter, sitting at his desk, happily writing away. And by his elbow is a French newspaper from June the 29th, 1914, reporting, of course, the assassination in Sarajevo of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And of course, on June the 29th, no one knew exactly what was going to happen, although many people, including Clemenceau, in France were predicting. In fact, Clemenceau's headline a day or two after this was "Into the Abyss." He had no doubt what was going to happen in Europe. And of course, the war came, and the war came also to Giverny. It was northwest of Paris, fortunately, so it was not invaded by the Germans as so much of eastern France was, northeastern France. But the war did come close, and it came in different forms. Because of the fact that there were Belgian refugees in France by August 1914. There was a hospital for wounded soldiers in Giverny by September of 1914. And the wounded soldiers in the hospital were fed, they were nourished with vegetables from Monet's garden. He had a vegetable patch in Giverny as well as the flower garden. And his donation of vegetables to the wounded soldiers was just one of the numerous ways that he supported the war effort, albeit in a somewhat modest way. But it also came in terms of the threat from the Germans. This is Levallois, which is about 30 miles from Giverny, but the Zeppelins would swing in through the west of Paris, and all they would have had to do was go a few miles farther west, and they could have come to Giverny. And on two occasions, in August 1914 and March 1918, it looked as if Paris would fall when the Germans made their pushes across the Marne. And Monet, everyone left Giverny in August 1914. All of the Americans left. There was an American colony in Giverny at that time, many of them painters. And unsurprisingly, virtually all of them left, including some of Monet's in-laws, because despite his supposed denigration of Americans, he had American in-laws, the Butler family, because his stepdaughter had married Theodore Earle Butler, the American painter. And the Butlers left. They went to New York. And Monet made a defiant statement that he was going to stay regardless. And if those barbarians, as he always called the Germans in those years, wish to kill me, I shall die among my canvases in front of my life's work. War also came to him because his only surviving son, as well as several of his stepchildren, went to war. His youngest son, Michel, signed up in 1915 and went to the Battle of Verdun in 1916. And as Monet said, with, I think, superb understatement, Michel has seen some terrible sights. And I think there's no question that Michel suffered shell shock or post-traumatic stress disorder from reports that we have of him during and after the war. So the question then is, with all of this, what was Monet doing as the war broke out? He had just got his passion and desire to paint back, and maybe even his abilities to paint back, when this catastrophe descended on Europe. And the answer to what he did is that he painted. He painted almost maniacally through the war years. and he painted on this larger scale. Once again, just to point out, these are not paintings that are 3 feet high. They're enormous canvases on which he was trying out the new motifs in his water garden. And there was a huge irony unto the fact that Monet, who had made his name painting in the open air, by the summer of 1915, had what must be world's largest painting studio that he himself was embarrassed by because it was so large and so ugly. And all of you who put your hand up earlier have been there, because that is now the cavernous gift shop at Giverny that you go inside to buy the memorabilia. Monet had, by 1915, had this beautiful studio, but in it, I'm sorry, this ugly studio, but in it he could put his beautiful paintings. He could range them around and he could test them out, and he could work in the winter. In the fall and winter, in the foul weather, he painted indoors, and I describe in the book the way Monet, despite what he often said, probably painted indoors at least as much as he painted outdoors. But then in the spring and summer, he did paint outdoors. And once again, he's working on a very large canvas here beside the pond, and this is in July 1915, the very moment when the studio is beginning to be built. This is from a film that was done by his friend Sacha Guitry, who was a great film director, actor, playwright. And Sacha decided that he wanted to make a kind of propaganda film proclaiming the glories of French culture and French art, French music. And he went around and made these little films with a hand crank camera. And if you put this into YouTube, you can see Monet. You can see him painting. This is a still I've taken from it. You can see him in front of his easel, walking around his garden, and so forth, and get a very good portrait of the way he worked. And the way he worked was, as I say, maniacal, because he worked almost nonstop. He got up very early, went to the side of the pond, and painted on these large canvases. And when he needed a haircut, for example, he wouldn't even take a break to go to the local barber. The local barber had to come to him. He would be summoned to the side of the pond and cut Monet's hair as he worked. And so the fruit of all of this labor were these, what he called the grandes études, or the great studies. And these are works, some of which will look very familiar to you, one of which will look very familiar to large works. There, as you can see, they're over 5 feet high by 6 feet wide in many cases. And they're paintings that really are showpieces in the museums in which they feature today. He did more than 60 of them. So that in itself is a great amount of painting, given their size and given the prolific number of them. But they're not even the half of it, because besides doing these, he was doing what by January 1915 he was calling the Grande Décoration, the Great Decoration. And these were the absolutely massive water lily paintings that are 6.5 feet high, by in the case of the one in the Carnegie, almost 20 feet wide, or in the case of the one at MoMA in New York, more than 40 feet wide, or the Agapanthus Triptych, which is now split between St. Louis, Cleveland, and Kansas City, likewise about 42 feet wide. And he painted... It's known for certain, because 41 of them still exist. He painted 42 of them. One was burned in a fire at MoMA in the late 1950s. There were 42 that have been definitively accounted for. But people who saw his work in the 20s claimed there were more than 50. So there were more than 50 works that were 6 feet, six high by, say, 14 feet wide, 20 feet wide, maybe 42 feet wide. So massive compositions. And as Monet painted through the warriors, the question that everyone had, and that Monet himself had, was what on earth was he going to do with it? Why was he doing it? For whom was he doing it? What was going to become of it? And Monet himself sometimes laughed at the folly of it all and said, what am I doing? What can be done with all of this? And he got his idea, a glimmer of what could happen, in 1918 with the armistice, when he wrote to Clemenceau the day later and said that he was on the verge of finishing two decorative paintings that he wanted to sign on the Great Day of Victory and have Clemenceau offered to the state on his behalf. So of all of this painting he had done, he was going to give two paintings to Clemenceau to offer to the state, and they would go in the Museum of Decorative Arts in Paris. Clemenceau then, a week later, on his first day off since being prime minister, he was appointed a year earlier, on his first day off, he came to Giverny to have lunch and choose these two paintings. But what appears to have happened is Clemenceau thought, why should I just take two paintings when all of these acres of painted canvas are on offer? And let's supersize the donation and have Monet give something much more than just two paintings. And in fact, that's what happened. And in 1920, on Monet's 80th birthday, in October 1920, it was announced that he was going to give 12 large canvases to the French state. And I describe what happens next, much of which is unhappy for Monet because he immediately began to regret doing this. He regretted it because by this time he began having trouble with his eyesight, and he thought maybe it wasn't possible for him to judge the quality of what he was producing. And there's a great quote that he gave to Clemenceau when he said, "When I am dead, I shall find their imperfections more bearable." And he, as I describe in the book, he developed a weird obsession with them and decided that he needed to keep them with him. If he released them, it's like the Shroud of Penelope or the Tales of 1001 Nights of Scheherazade, that if he finished the Grande Décoration and if he gave it away, he would die and that it would all be over. So he developed this very strange obsession with them. We're coming close to the end of our time, and my editor, when I was telling him about what I was going to talk about a couple of weeks ago, he said, just remember, you don't have to tell them everything. Leave them hanging. Leave them wanting more. Make them buy the book. So I'll just wrap up very quickly by saying what ultimately happened to not two, not 12, but 22 of the large canvases is they finally went to Paris. But they went to Paris only once Monet died. He died in December 1926, and only when he was safely buried in the ground in Giverny did the paintings leave his studio. Monet finally got not one circular room of modest dimensions, but two large elliptical rooms across which there are more than 100 yards of canvas. It would take Usain Bolt 9.6 seconds to run past all of Monet's paintings in the Orangerie in Paris. You'll notice the date, 1927, when it opened about 6 months after Monet's death. When it was unveiled, it was regarded as a critical mistake. The reviews were very harsh. Monet's early work was still appreciated. His mid-period work still appreciated. But the late Monet was said to be no longer Impressionism, but its decline, the work of an old man. He'd committed artistic suicide. It was the truly pitiful crowning of his career, etc., etc. And in the book, I discuss the reasons for this, for these negative evaluations, which have a lot to do with the artistic taste of the time. But of course, if you wait long enough, the reviews change. It was suddenly, by 1950, regarded as the Sistine Chapel of Impressionism, the greatest triumph, one of the summits of French genius, or in one of the most perspicacious telegrams ever sent, Alfred H. Barr of the Museum of Modern Art in New York sent a telegram to his curator traveling in France, and in capital letters he said, "Buy Monet," and by which he meant buy one of the large water lilies from Michel Monet, who was still alive at that time and who had all of these things still in the studio and now was beginning to sell them off at increasingly high prices to collectors. And that, incidentally, the painting that was bought at that point is the one that burned in 1958 at MoMA. It was much mourned. People wrote in asking to have relics of it, to get ashes of it. And MoMA very quickly then purchased another one, this absolutely massive one. So I'll just conclude by saying that in works like this one at MoMA or at the Carnegie or in the Agapanthus triptych, we're offered exactly the scenario that I said at the beginning that we all desire to do, I think, with the Monet painting, to walk into it, because he's with these wraparound canvases, he's given us this installation or immersive experience in which we can participate vicariously in this magical world that he, with his hands and the hands of his six gardeners, had created at Giverny. Anyway, I hope we have time for at least a few questions, and we've got a microphone which is going to be passed around.
So thank you very much, Ross.
Thank you.
And I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Ross King speak about Mad Enchantment, The Water Lilies of Claude Monet. Who would like to ask the first question?
Ross, thank you for a very interesting lecture. What fascinated me was the volume of Monet's work. It was absolutely incredible that he was able to paint as much as he did. But how did the estate allow so much of the work to get to other museums out of Paris?
The simple answer to that, really, is they weren't in Paris. It was believed that the. Are you speaking of the water lilies or
yes,
Monet's paintings in general?
Basically, you showed that one slide of, I believe Cleveland, even Portland, Oregon. How did all of these other institutions get hold of the? Of this work from the estate?
Well, in 1920, the director of the Luxembourg Museum in Paris went on a tour of America, and he went to Boston and saw the MFA. He went to the Art Institute of Chicago, went to the Metropolitan Museum, etc. And he then wrote back to his colleagues saying, the Americans have a far, far better collection of French Impressionism than we do. And the reason for that, and arguably America has probably, maybe I should say inarguably, America today has a much better collection of Monet and Impressionism than France does, because the great works there are at the Musée d'Orsay and the Orangerie. But the answer really is that America embraced Impressionism decades before French officialdom did. The curator of the Luxembourg was one of the few people who really had a passion for the Impressionists at that time. And so when Monet came up for sale, the Americans perhaps had a deeper pockets, but also, I think, crucially, a much greater love for the paintings of Monet and the paintings of the Impressionists in general. And so Impressionism, and I discussed this at the end of The Judgment of Paris as well, Impressionism as a successful art historical movement owes a lot to, as I was saying earlier today, Gilded Age America, and the fact that Americans loved these scenes of beautiful landscapes, whereas the French, and again, just to make a pitch for Judgment of Paris again, the French wanted something very different. They wanted this official art that would be morally improving and that would tell historical stories, whereas the Impressionists shed all of that baggage and painted in a very different style. And so that's why America has such a wonderful collection spread across many museums.
Next question.
Thank you very much. In Giverny, in his garden, of course, with the Japanese bridge, and if I remember correctly, in his house, there are also quite a few Japanese works. What was the relationship between Monet and Japan? Did he ever travel there? I mean, how did this passion spring up?
I'm delighted you asked that question, because that's such an important part of the story, and I do have it in the book. And, if I had 90 minutes, I might be able to discuss something like that, because of the story really begins for Monet and Japan in 1871. In 1870, he left France, went to England because of the Franco-Prussian War, came back on a leisurely route through the Low Countries because he wanted to paint tulips and windmills. And the story goes, and it's a story told by a very close friend of his, so I see no reason to doubt it. The story is that he went into a spice shop in Zaandam to buy, who knows what, pepper, something like that, bought it. It was wrapped up. He got it back to his hotel, looked at it, unwrapped it, and looked at the wrapping paper and saw that it was a Japanese woodblock print that had been sent over with the spices, in which the fat grocer, as he was described by Monet's friend, didn't recognize the value of or didn't appreciate it. And Monet then rushed back to the spice shop and bought all of the wrapping paper. And that really began, you're absolutely right, the walls of his house were papered with, he had 231 Japanese woodblock prints, and he dealt with a Japanese importer of prints in Paris throughout his life. And that was one of the passions he also shared with Clemenceau, who was also a great collector of Japanese art and lover of Japanese culture. And Monet was blown away by what he saw in 1871 in the woodblock print. And he said, if you want to compare me to anyone, compare me to the, he said, the old Japanese, by which he meant people like Hokusai and Hiroshige and painters like that, artists like that from the mid part of the mid and early part of the 19th century. And in the book, I discuss what he took away from them or what influenced him. In many ways, it was the motifs that he, you know, his garden owes a lot to Japanese woodblock prints. It's not a French garden. I think we now think of it, it has become so natural to us that we've lost the essential strangeness of it. And in fact, Monet was attacked during the war years for painting something that wasn't French, because it looked oriental. In fact, it, you know, with the curving Japanese bridge, with the peonies, with the irises, all of these things were not indigenous to France. They were structures and features that owed their the identity elsewhere. And so I'll just conclude by saying he was so passionate about Japanese art that if a Japanese artist in Paris wrote to him, the red carpet would be rolled out and the artist would be invited to come. He'd get a tour of the garden, see the art, etc. And there is a gentleman who's asking about the sort of great, wonderful surfeit of Monet and Impressionism in America. Japan also has a great collection of Monet paintings, thanks to a man I discussed in the book, Kojiro Matsukata, who was head of Kawasaki Industries and who began buying Monet paintings in 1920 and was one of the few people who could pry part of the Grande Décoration away from Monet before he died. And I discussed that incident in the book. But it was a very close relationship.
Yes, the American private collections that were accumulated during the Belle Epoque, have they stayed in private family homes or are they now into public institutions?
Most of them are in public institutions because the people who collected them, in many cases, were great philanthropists. And so Bertha Palmer was a wonderful philanthropist. Many of her works ended up in the Art Institute of Chicago, which also has paintings from the collection of Martin Ryerson, who bought almost as many as her. And so I think that's one of the nice things about Monet's paintings that came to America, that if he feared they were going, I think maybe what he feared was what people often today fear about if a Gauguin is sold, Gauguin goes on the block for $180 million or something like that. There is no institution that can find that. Very few institutions could find those funds, and that is going to go into a private collection. And the fear is that it will never be seen again. And something similar to that did happen with Monet's Water Lilies, which was in the Corcoran in Washington. That was sold 2 years ago for $25 million, and no institution got it. It went into private hands. No one knows whose private hands they are. But presumably that situation will work its way out, and within a generation, those works will enter public collections. So fortunately, the answer is most of those are now on public display in various museums.
Thank you very much for your lecture. I had a question about the what do you think these later paintings add to the artistic heritage of Impressionism, which really started in, as you say, 1871, 1872. He was painting his garden in the 90s and the first part of the 20th century. So what is different about these larger, almost cinemascopic paintings?
I think it's, though, in some ways you answered the question with larger and cinemascopic. And the other thing I would add is abstract. Because one of the things was noted about his paintings in 1909, that great Water Lily exhibition, someone said the abstraction of art can go no farther. And of course, more than a century later, we know that it could and did. But nevertheless, these were seen as very radical. And this was the period of Cubism and Fauvism and these new isms that were coming and threatening Impressionism. And it looked as if Monet now had, well, indeed he had, thrown down a kind of challenge to the new 20th century forms of art. And what he did with the scale of them, and one response to, which is what makes it different from Impressionism, because of course with Impressionism we always think of a painting that's maybe 2.5 feet high by 3 feet wide, or something like that. But these are obviously massive, as I've been saying, immersive paintings. And that was again and again said to be what Impressionism had failed at. And once in the book and also in The Judgment of Paris, I discussed this ambition for public art that the French had, that no art was good unless it was public. And that was really what Monet was trying to do. The Impressionists were derided partly because they painted works that were bought by maybe middle-class people to decorate their homes, sit above the fireplace mantelpiece or something like that, whereas art was meant to be public. And so all of the great reputations in French art previously had been made through public art with people like Delacroix, who covered, I mean, you can't in a room of state in France or a church look up without seeing Delacroix paintings across the ceiling or on the walls. And it was repeatedly voiced in the early part of the 20th century that Impressionism in some ways had failed because no Impressionist painter had ever achieved that kind of lasting physical monument. The only one who had to that point was in America. That was Mary Cassatt at the Columbian Exhibition in Chicago, where she did a great mural piece. But none of the other French Impressionists, none of the French Impressionists had ever managed to do that. The last thing I'll say in response to your question is, I suppose the legacy that it had was in many ways abstraction. And there is a link between Kandinsky and Monet. Kandinsky really set the record for being the one who first achieved abstraction, complete abstraction, in 1913. And his inspiration for it was Monet. He said that he was able to see one of his haystack paintings. No one's sure which one it was or quite where he saw it. But he said he could not identify the subject of it. And therefore, it became a kind of, through his ignorance of French agricultural practice in the 19th century, it became non-objective art. And he said he realized that form and color could be liberated from the natural world. And that's when he then began experimenting with his own abstraction. And there's just a quick point about Monet and abstraction. It's often said that Jackson Pollock and the abstract expressionists were influenced by Monet. That's a false genealogy that in some ways was promoted by putting the MoMA, Monet water lilies very close to Jackson Pollock's drip paintings. But in fact, Pollock had not seen these works and was probably unaware of them. And he looked to Cubism, Surrealism, and Indian sand painting and Mexican murals and things like that, not Monet, who was at his lowest ebb critically, or these paintings were at their lowest ebb critically. And in fact, as I describe in the book, Monet owes more to Jackson Pollock than Pollock does to Monet, because Pollock's paintings made people reassess huge canvases which had no perspective. And many of Monet's water lily paintings almost look like action paintings. And that really is when MoMA became, and other institutions became interested in his work. The next generation of abstract painters in America, like Ellsworth Kelly, Sam Francis, Jack Youngerman, people like Joan Mitchell, Jean-Paul Riepel, all of them looked very definitely to Monet. And in fact, as I describe in the book, Ellsworth Kelly in 1952 made a pilgrimage to Giverny to talk to Michel Monet and to see the large water lily paintings that had been rolled up and left in for almost 30 years in Monet's studio.
Thank you so much. You mentioned that Kandinsky was inspired by Monet, but I'm wondering whether the feeling was reciprocal, if there was any, because when did Kandinsky start using things that were inspired by Monet, and was Monet still alive to see it, and did he know Kandinsky's work? Thanks.
I've never found a comment Monet made on Kandinsky, but Monet's view of younger artists was not always all that charitable. He, in some ways, he supported and encouraged people like Matisse, who was a great fan of his, and the Fauves in general were, and I think we can see the parallels between and among them. But he did not like Cubism. He said, he claimed never to have seen it. He said, I will not look at it. It would only make me angry. But the painter he detested the most of all, detested his painting and detested him, possibly justifiably, as a person was Paul Gauguin. Gauguin, of course, split the Impressionists. He was really the one that led, he was such a divisive personality, he really led to the splitting, the end of the movement in the 1880s. And Monet, I think, resented that, but he also resented, and he didn't show it in exhibition because of Gauguin, but he also detested Gauguin's art and detested him personally. But so he wasn't, I never found what he said about Kandinsky. Possibly he would have been flattered by that. I'm not sure he would have appreciated some of his later work.
One of the characteristics of Monet's earlier middle work was that you could see it up close and it looked very abstract, and then you could back away, back away, back away, and it came into focus as if there was something about his eyesight that did this. And it, I think in the greater abstractions at the end, it didn't have the same thing. But what has there ever been a solution to that mystery about his paintings that just... It's just such an amazing thing that you can go 25 feet away and then it's in perfect focus.
And he doesn't describe the technique that he used in order to achieve that, because he was an intuitive painter, not a scientific one. The other people who were trying to do that were, of course, Seurat and Paul Signac, the Pointillist painters. And they came up with a scientific formula, which was you took the diagonal of a painting, so you looked at it diagonally, or you measured the diagonal, how it was from corner to corner, and then multiplied that by 3, and that was the ideal viewing distance, so it could be figured out like that. Monet did not work like that. It was very intuitive, and the best insight we get into that process is his letters to his ophthalmologist, or his eye doctor, in the 20s, when he's saying, "You don't understand, I have to not only have eyesight from 3 feet, I need to have eyesight from 10 feet, eyesight from 15 feet. But his works repay both very close study. I mean, I was just looking at this one in Chicago 3 days ago, and if you stand in this corner and look at it, if you could have put a raking light on it, it's very very sculptural, because he's added the leaves with great texture. And it does make no sense when you see it from that distance. And so he was continually moving back and forward. And that's what we're forced to do with his paintings. That's what he wants us to do. They're ambulatory. You walk forward and backward, and in the orangery, you have to walk across them. You walk, you take a stroll or a promenade past all of these.
Time for one last question. Okay, is there one?
Oh, great. If I may. You talked about his relationship with some of the other painters. I'd like to know if there was any affection for, support of, or kinship with any of the women Impressionists of that era, besides Mary Cassatt.
The one who's most famous and was most cherished, of course, was Berthe Morisot, who became the sister-in-law of Edouard Manet. And I write about her a lot in The Judgment of Paris, because she was such an important character in the life of Manet, Edouard Manet, who painted her numerous times, and I think who was almost certainly in love with her, as she was, I think, almost certainly in love with him. And so there was this sort of romance. And when a producer 10 years ago wanted to do something with Judgment of Paris, he said, "Can I make a love affair? Can I make Manet?" And I said, "Absolutely not," which might explain why the movie never got made. The woman painter that Claude Monet was closest to was Blanche Ochday, who was his daughter-in-law / stepdaughter. She was married to his son Jean, who died in 1914, and she was a painter in her own right and a talented painter, and her works are in various public collections in France. She, however, stopped painting in 1914 to really look after Monet. And I said Clemenceau is the second person in the drama that I'm describing. The third person is Blanche, because she, as Clemenceau said, without her, there would have been no Grande Décoration, because she was the one who gave him the moral support that he lacked after the death of Elise. And so she really stepped into the shoes of her mother in many ways and sort of kept Monet going and gave him the sort of encouragement and comfort and things like, and companionship that he lacked after Elise's death. And sadly, she stopped painting. She devoted the last dozen years to Monet.
Okay, one last one.
Thank you so much. I was kind of intrigued by the relationship you described with Clemenceau, which I mean, I knew, but I didn't know the extent. It's kind of an interesting parallel to like what Cézanne had with Zola, like very kind of close relationship until falling out. But I was wondering if what does he write in his diaries or Clemenceau, like what is his response and after Monet passes away, and also does it have anything to do with the institutionalization of Monet in France with the museums and stuff like that? Was he early on supportive of the statue?
Yes, the Clemenceau, what Monet would have succeeded pre-1914 without Clemenceau. He wouldn't have succeeded. There would be no Orangerie without Clemenceau. In the book, I describe him as a creator of museums. He was, because he was such a powerful figure and interested in the arts, we need another Clemenceau today, someone of his power and passion for the arts to push through these initiatives. Monet would have succeeded without him pre-1914, but the letters, there are many letters between them, and they're very affecting to read because Clemenceau really believed that Monet was the best painter in history, and he thanks him. And maybe this is the gift that painters give us. He thanks him. He says, thank you for teaching me how to see light, how to see a river, how to see trees. Talked about his life had much more meaning because of what he learned from looking at Monet's paintings, and that Monet had sort of shifted his way of looking at the world. And one thing I've been wondering lately is whether there is a kind of parallel between a political figure as important as Clemenceau was 100 years ago and an artistic figure as important as Monet was, and have both politicians and artists descended in value or taste or prominence, or, you know, are these friendships? And I was in Kansas City and I asked that question two or three nights ago, and someone said Harry S. Truman and Thomas Hart Benton, which had a very good anecdote about it. So I guess they have existed, you know, 50, 60 years ago. But I'd be interested to know if there is a politician today who has the passion for the arts and a friendship, crucially, with artists, such that, as we saw in this wonderful dynamic between Clemenceau and Claude Monet.
Are you asking us to reevaluate politicians?
Well, yes.
No, it really is a great story. To have that, it gives you hope that the support for the arts will come from the state some of the time, and certainly has many, many times. This time it seemed to be from friendship. A lot of time it was just, you know, a competition between one king and the other king, you know.
Those relationships existed in the Renaissance, right, with Michelangelo and Paul III and even with Julius II, Leonardo da Vinci and Ludovico Sforza. But I think it's much rarer today that we have that kind of confluence between politics and art.
To the future. More. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 115th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks for coming.